Hi, welcome to Al-Muqaddima. My name is Siavish. In 641 CE, the relatively young Rashidun Caliphate invaded Egypt. Their army had already destroyed the mighty Byzantine Empire in Syria and Palestine. They had also broken the great Persian Sassanid Empire and opened the gateway into Persia and Central Asia. They had arrived outside Alexandria in March, and by September of the same year, Alexandria had fallen. The rest of Egypt fell in line soon after as well. More than six centuries of Roman and Greek rule of Egypt had come to an end. Alexandria was an important city, and its loss was huge for the Byzantine Empire. It was a rich port city and a vital commercial hub. It connected Constantinople to the rest of Egypt. Through their control of Alexandria, along with key port cities on the Syrian coast, the Romans boasted about the Mediterranean Sea being a Roman lake. That was no longer the case. It had also been a famous center of learning, and many great scholars of late antiquity had lived and worked there. This was in part thanks to the Great Library of Alexandria, which had been built by Ptolemy II in the 200s BCE. At its peak, it housed anywhere from 50,000 to 500,000 scrolls with important scientific works scribed on them. So, what happened to this great ancient library and the incredible amount of knowledge it held in its heart? Well, in 641, when the Muslims conquered Alexandria, their commander, Amr ibn al-As, was told about the library and its vast collection of scrolls. According to our sources, which I'll talk more about in a minute, Amr was actually impressed by the library. However, he wrote to the caliph back in Medina, the capital, asking for his orders on what to do with the contents of the library. The caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab, wrote in reply, "As for the books you mention, if there is in them what complies with the Book of God, the Quran, then it is already there and is not needed. And if what is in these books contradict the Book of God, then again, there is no need for it. Hence, you can proceed to destroy them." Amr ibn al-As then had the scrolls burned in the public baths for heating. It said that they were enough to provide heating for 6 months. So that makes it quite clear that Caliph Umar ibn al-Khattab, the second caliph of Islam, ordered the destruction of the scrolls at the Library of Alexandria. But is the story true? Okay, I'm not gonna make you watch the intro and then the Patreon plug. I'll just tell you right now, no, it's not true. Not even a little bit. It has been mentioned by Abdul Latif al-Baghdadi around 1203, Ibn al-Qifti around 1227, al-Maqrizi in the 1400s, and Gregory Bar Hebraeus in the mid-13th century, likely after Ibn al-Qifti. Ibn Khaldun tells the same story around the 1370s or 80s, but he changes the library to a Persian one. Anyhow, we'll ignore him for now and concern ourselves with Alexandria. With four different people telling the same story, you'd expect it to be at least somewhat true. However, they were all born more than 500 years after the event that they're talking about. Plus, I'm pretty sure that Bar Hebraeus copied Ibn al-Qifti and al-Maqrizi copied Abdul Latif al-Baghdadi. I have no proof for that, I'm just going off of the similarities between them. You can ignore that if you want. None of them, however, tell us where they got the information. There's no reliable chain of narration. Plus, no one wrote about this event for almost 600 years. Even Christian sources that write about the conquest of Alexandria, like Patriarch Eutychius of Alexandria in the 10th century and Coptic historian John of Nicaea in the late 7th century, don't mention this at all. John of Nicaea is of special notice because he lived quite close to the conquest of Egypt, and he's really not pulling any punches in his critique of the Muslim conquerors at all. If it had happened, there's basically no way that John of Nicaea wouldn't have written it down. This would have been a pretty big deal to just not mention. So if the story is true, why didn't even the Christians write it down? Both Ibn al-Qifti and Gregory Bar Hebraeus mention a man named Yahya al-Nahvi, which translates to John or Johannes the Grammarian. He was apparently a bishop of Alexandria and had his own problems with the local clergy and the Byzantine Empire. It had something to do with the fact that he was a non-Chalcedonian Christian. Anyhow, according to Ibn al-Qifti, he was the one who talked to Amr ibn al-As and told him about the books. Muslim scholars have written quite a bit about Yahya al-Nahvi. In fact, the source by Ibn al-Qifti is actually a biography of al-Nahvi. However, Muslims seem to have been confused about the person that was Yahya al-Nahvi. It's possible that Yahya al-Nahvi, as talked about in the Islamic sources, is an amalgamation of multiple figures because we don't know who he is. There's debate about his very identity. The leading candidate for the real Yahya al-Nahvi, Johannes Grammaticus, actually died in 575 CE. Another candidate is John Philoponus, who also died in 570 CE. They never even knew of something called Islam. In 570 CE, the Prophet Muhammad himself was probably not even born yet. Moving on, I'm in very good company when I say that the whole story is fictional. As far back as the 18th century, historians have denied the authenticity of this story, when no less a historian than Edward Gibbon himself was, quote, tempted to deny both the fact and the consequences. He questions the story on the same basis as I mentioned above. He even questions if a large number of scrolls were actually present in Alexandria, given that the library had been in decline for centuries. Here's Premodernist to tell you more about that.
It can be hard to separate the myth from the reality regarding the Library of Alexandria. I mean, there is a historical core of truth to what we hear. There was a library founded in Alexandria in the 3rd century BCE. It was associated with the Temple to the Muses, otherwise known as the Museum. There were scholars who studied there. There was a library collection held there. All that's true. But getting further on in time into the 2nd and 1st centuries BCE, the situation in Alexandria deteriorated. There were civil wars in the country. There were riots in Alexandria. Sometimes rulers would persecute the philosophers at the museum. So it was no longer an appealing location for scholars from elsewhere to come and study. And so in a very real sense, the Library of Alexandria, at least the library as it exists in our dreams, as it exists in our legends about it, as a place of science and enlightenment, as a beacon of hope for the progress of humanity, all these things that modern-day people associate with the Library of Alexandria, to the extent that the library had ever had those qualities back in the 3rd century BCE, those qualities were not present in the 2nd or 1st centuries. And then Julius Caesar came along, and in the course of a battle, he set fire to some ships. That fire spread to the shore, damaged some buildings in Alexandria. That may or may not have affected the museum and affected the library collection there. We don't know. It depends on how we interpret the sources, and modern historians disagree on that. But even if the fire did affect the library, we can say two things definitively about this. First of all, he was not solely responsible for the destruction of the Library of Alexandria, because the Library of Alexandria was already in decline, and like I said, did not exist in the form that it had in the 3rd century BCE. And secondly, we know that the museum continued to exist into the Common Era, and a library continued to exist there at the museum, until at some point in perhaps the 2nd or 3rd centuries of the Common Era, the library ceased to be important at the museum. We don't know exactly for sure. It just sort of fades away. Meanwhile, there was another library at another temple called the Serapeum. It was a temple dedicated to the god Serapis. And that held an important library in the late Roman period, during the period of time in which Christianity was growing in Egypt. In 391 CE, Christians destroyed the Serapeum and converted the site to Christian worship. Now, did they destroy the library that was there? We don't know. We have sources that talk about the destruction of the Serapeum, and they go into some detail about the events surrounding that, but they don't talk about the destruction of the books. Presumably, something happened to the library of the Serapeum. But with regard to the story of the legendary Library of Alexandria, what happened to the Serapeum is not relevant. So certainly, while there were libraries in Alexandria and continued to be libraries throughout the Greco-Roman world, all the way up to the time of the conquest and after, in the sense of the library, that library of legend, that library that modern authors talk about, that certainly did not exist at the time of the conquest.
Thank you, Premodernist. He has made a video about the Library of Alexandria over on his channel, so be sure to watch it after this one. Other than Edward Gibbon, Bernard Lewis denied it. Bertrand Russell denied it. Alfred J. Butler denied it. Mustafa Alibadi denied it. The list goes on and on and on. For more than 300 years, historians have been denying this, trying to put this myth to bed, but nope, it won't die. I'll talk about that in a moment, but first, why does this myth exist then? The earliest source, as I mentioned, is al-Baghdadi, but the way he words it makes it look like the myth existed before him as well. Unfortunately, the only explanation I could find comes from a chapter by Bernard Lewis in Mustafa al-Ibadi's What Happened to the Ancient Library of Alexandria. I personally am no fan of Bernard Lewis. I agree with much of the criticism laid against him by Edward Said. However, that doesn't mean that we can just discredit all his work and call it Orientalist. So I will present what he said about the myth of the burning of the scrolls. He thinks that the myth probably came into existence during the reign of Salahuddin Ayyubi, or Saladin. Now, Saladin, as you might know, had dissolved the Shia Fatimid Caliphate in Cairo. He was a Sunni, so he also brought Egypt under the umbrella of the Sunni Abbasid Caliph back in Baghdad. We know for sure that Saladin did some serious Sunnification in Egypt after the dissolution of the Fatimid Caliphate. That included selling much of the collections and treasures of the Fatimid Caliphs in public auctions, including their libraries. Presumably, these libraries housed a lot of Shia-leaning books and manuscripts. It's possible that there was criticism from scholars and intellectuals in Egypt. Some of them might have had Shia leanings themselves. So to dismiss criticism, it's possible that this myth was invented at some point to justify the destruction of libraries that don't, quote, align with the word of God. I personally am not convinced by this argument, but still, it's one explanation. It could make sense when you know that both Abd al-Latif al-Baghdadi and Ibn al-Qifti were associated with the courts of Saladin and his dynasty. However, the way that the documents are written doesn't really make them look like structured political propaganda, at least not to me. But then again, I'm not qualified to judge such historical documents, so think what you want. Okay, you might be thinking that the intro hasn't even rolled yet and the question has already been answered, so what is this video really about? Well, it's not about the Library of Alexandria. It's about something much more contemporary. It's about Islamophobia. This video is brought to you by, well, you guys. Thanks to my patrons for supporting the channel and making these videos possible. Al Muqaddama is funded only by Patreon, and as you can see, the videos take a long time to research, edit, and produce. And it's only because of my patrons that I am able to put this kind of time into these videos and keep them free from any kind of paywall. So if you want to pledge a dollar or more to support the channel, you can head over to my Patreon. Link is in the description. You can also become a member right here on YouTube. There's some cool stuff that comes with it. Back to the video. The thing that sparked this video was a bunch of comments on some of my videos about how Umar ibn al-Khattab destroyed the Library of Alexandria and how Muslims have done nothing but destroy civilizations. To my surprise, I got such comments on my video about how medieval Muslims thought about ancient Egypt. That was just a nice little video about curious people and their attempt at understanding an ancient civilization, but I kept getting comments like this. Now, I usually don't talk about Islamophobia on this channel because the response to outcries of Islamophobia is usually that criticism is not Islamophobia. Muslims can't take criticism and accuse everyone they don't like of Islamophobia. In that way, I guess they've even taken the right to complain about Islamophobia from Muslims. However, there's a difference between genuine criticism and Islamophobia. That difference is obviously the intention of the person, but since we can't know that, we can use another metric, the knowledge of the person talking and their willingness to be corrected. For this video about whether or not Umar ibn al-Khattab burned the Library of Alexandria, I had to do very little research. I was surprised by how well this question has already been answered when you just Google it. This blog, this person on Quora, this Wikipedia page, this blog, this page from Britannica, this person from Reddit, this quite easily accessible paper from actual academic scholars. The list goes on and on and on. Now, I know, of course, people on Quora and Reddit aren't exactly authorities on such subjects, but they do provide a very good starting point. You can then do your own research, as I did for this video, to verify them. However, all these people who made this comment on my videos didn't bother to even Google it. They probably just read it on Facebook or Twitter and parroted it. That is Islamophobia, because what you read fits with your bigoted, ignorant understanding of a huge and diverse religious tradition and of almost 2 billion people around the world, and you didn't even bother to look it up. By the way, remember last year when the Iranian state gave the death penalty to 15,000 protesters and everyone in the world immediately denounced that? That really says something, doesn't it? Again, it's not Islamophobic to say that, for example, the Arab conquests were bloody. All conquests by their very nature are bloody. Or to say that a Muslim ruler or figure or state or empire was and or is bad and committed atrocities. But it is Islamophobic to say this, and, well, all this. To say that a Muslim empire invaded a country and that's how Islam entered that country is valid. It's true in many cases. However, I'll point out that Islam also spread through trade to far-off regions like Central Asia, Southeast Asia, and West and East Africa. But to call the Muslims who live in those countries today invaders is Islamophobic, because those Muslims have lived there for a long time and have nothing to do with whatever empire you're talking about. It has become very acceptable and frankly mundane even to use Islamophobic language online. You can't say the word Islam on Reddit or Twitter or X or whatever it's called these days without people outright calling Islam a cancer. Other religions get hostility too, but perhaps Islam and Christianity get the most, and that's not surprising because they are the two largest religions by population. However, even Christianity, I don't think, gets the kind of treatment that Islam gets. However, props to this guy for hitting them both in one swing. From my experience, it's much more difficult to have a discussion related to Islam and Muslims online than it is with any other religion because Islamophobic language is much more acceptable online. All of that is driven not by logic or rational ideas, but rather by just xenophobia and bigotry. Racism is thinly veiled behind an argument of ideology made on misinformation that tries to paint almost 2 billion people in the same color. When have you ever seen that many people unite or even agree on anything? It means a very different thing to be a Muslim in Morocco than it does to be one in Indonesia. Okay, you might say that Islam is not a race, so it's not racism, but Islam has been racialized. Non-Muslims, who people thought looked Muslim, have been victims of hate crimes. We rarely ever hear of a hate crime committed against a white Muslim, but we do hear about Islamophobic attacks against, for example, Sikhs, who aren't Muslim but I guess look Muslims to racist assholes. All of this is justified through ideology, by saying that Islam is somehow more violent and incompatible with modern life, especially in the West, than any other religion is. Again, that is not accurate or even logical. It's just a thinly veiled way of attacking people who look different than the people saying this. Years of Islamophobia post 9/11 has created an atmosphere in the world where Muslims are being turned into the other, and not just the other, but the dangerous other. The reason that I wanted to talk about Islamophobia today is actually two reasons. The rise of Islamophobia in India and the arrival of a fresh batch of Islamophobes on my channel. I'll talk about the latter first and the former later. I usually read all the comments on my videos, but recently I've had to quit doing that to protect my mental health. It all started when I made two shorts that featured Persia. One was about the contributions of Persians to Islamic thought, and the other was about the Abbasid Caliph Harun al-Rashid's attempt at destroying a pre-Islamic Persian monument. They were both just light-hearted, innocent appreciations of Persian culture from me. I personally have a lot of love and respect for Persian culture, especially their poetry. The second one was actually likely fictional, and I included that in the description, but no one was willing to listen, so I had to take it down. That one's on me because I didn't make it clear in the video that the story was likely made up. These shorts invited a lot of Persian nationalists who started commenting about how Islam ruined their great ancient civilization. Now, that's not really new, and frankly, fine. There's a point of view from where this seems valid. I don't agree with it, but I can see why these people would think that. However, their language was incredibly Islamophobic, and their comments were full of made-up propaganda and ahistoric lies. Like this, for example, and this, and all this. This has been debunked like 800 times. Then some Arabs came in and started calling them Majus, which is supposed to be a derogatory term that simply means Zoroastrian. Along with that, there were some other pretty nasty things. Then Tajiks and Afghans came in claiming that all Persian scholars were actually Tajik or Afghan. Then, right on cue, Hindu nationalists came in because, you know, they're always lurking about everywhere on the internet. Just say the word Muslim or Islam on the internet and a Hindu nationalist appears out of thin air. Also, coming back to Harun al-Rashid destroying a pre-Islamic building, he didn't. The whole story is likely made up. I talked about Saladin and his son trying to dismantle some pyramids in a video and I got comments like this. Just because someone dismantles an ancient structure doesn't mean that they or their religion has something against them. Most people in the olden days didn't respect structures of historical importance in the same way that we do today. Many ancient structures around the world were destroyed for construction material. Saladin tried to destroy a pyramid or did succeed in destroying one because he needed the stones to reinforce the walls of Cairo. The Temple of Karnak was being dismantled by locals to use its stones for their homes. The Pyramid of Djefre was probably dismantled by Roman Emperor Augustus for its construction materials. The British used bricks from the Indus Valley civilization sites to build their new projects in the area, which included the railway. Countless other examples of such deconstruction are found because, unfortunately, people didn't respect historical sites the way that we do today. This was not uniquely an Islamic phenomenon, but you know, if you're an ignorant bigot, then that's all you'll see. Side note here, some of them called me out for how I read Farsi. It's 2023, you can't shame people for having an accent or being bad at a foreign language. Anyhow, all this wouldn't matter if it was just trolls online yelling into the void. But that's not the case. This rhetoric seeps into people's minds and impacts their relationship with the people in their community. It leads to psychopaths lynching people in the streets and shooting up mosques. None of these comments are that new. I've been getting comments like these for a long time, pretty much since the channel exists. But recently, there have been a lot more of them. However, they've been more of a problem for me personally because of the other reason that I'm talking about this, the situation in India. Before I move on, I would like to say that an overwhelming majority of comments on my video about ancient Egypt were positive, and I really appreciate it. The support means the world to me. Usually, most of the comments on any video of mine are positive, with a few exceptions. Honestly, Muawiyah's mere name in the video title immediately breaks my like-dislike ratio. Okay, moving on to the situation in India. I know as a Pakistani, maybe my criticism of the Indian government doesn't mean much, and I know there will be Indians in the comments telling me to talk about Pakistan instead, and yeah, pretty bad things are happening in Pakistan as well. If I start talking about everything bad that's going on in the world, then this will be a very different channel. But, well, this is my channel, and this video is about me and my feelings about things, so you can just stop watching if you want. I've always had a certain amount of fascination with Indian politics, mainly because I think of them as a sort of a cousin state of ours, and as the world's biggest and most diverse democracy, it's fascinating how it works. I watch a lot of Indian news, so much so that I accidentally say some very Sanskrit terms when speaking Urdu at times, and the situation in India should worry us all. The full force of fake news, propaganda, politics of division and hatred is on display in the world's biggest democracy. The ruling party, the BJP, has openly divided the country into Hindus and everyone else. Right now, their main target is Muslims, but Christians and Sikhs have also been impacted. It's getting so crazy that recently, major TV channels in the country accused Muslims of causing the prices of tomatoes to rise in the Great Tomato Conspiracy of 2023. With the recent riots in France, the European capital of Islamophobia, these so-called news channels started blaming Muslims who live in France for the whole thing and warning fellow Indians about Muslims in their own country. Twitter was full of such tweets as well. People have been lynched because they were accused of possessing beef. These lynchings are becoming more and more common. Muslims have had their houses bulldozed for nothing. In fact, the bulldozer has become a symbol of Islamophobic sentiments among Hindu nationalists. A tragic train accident in June 2023 killed almost 300 people, and immediately, the day after the accident, Muslims were being blamed for it, rather than the government's negligence and incompetence. because the day of the accident was a Friday, a day holy for the Muslims, and near the spot of the accident, there was a mosque or an Islamic shrine or something. Later, it turned out to be a Hindu temple instead. Here's how one of BJP's leaders talks about Muslims.
We know where the Muslim population is large, there's always trouble because the Islamic ideology says so.
I mean, there's 200 million Muslims living in India. That's the second largest Muslim population in the world. And you're saying that wherever Muslims live, that's
a problem? If Muslims become more than 30%, that country is in danger.
That sounds like hatred. That sounds like language of hatred.
It's easy to say hatred. I'm being kind to them by not letting them come to India.
Article 14 of the Indian Constitution guarantees the right to equality, as you know, for all persons living in India.
I can tell you that's a misinterpretation of Article 14. Article 14 guarantees equality of equals. I'll give you an example.
Are all people not equal?
All people are not equal.
Muslims do not deserve equal rights to apply for citizenship.
There's no such thing as equal rights. They're not in an equal category.
By the way, this man has a PhD in economics from Harvard. This is really not uncommon. I'll link some videos in the description that talk more about this. Every other day, the country's Muslim population, much of which, by the way, is economically disadvantaged, is accused of some new thing. All these new kinds of imaginary jihads are crafted every single day, from love jihad and land jihad to tomato and video game jihad. All that propaganda is honestly ridiculous, but it's working, as clearly shown by the increasing number of Muslims being lynched by common citizens. All this air of Islamophobia has culminated in a horrendous situation in the world's largest democracy. I can't help but wonder if all of this goes back to 2001, when Islamophobia really picked up in the West, specifically the United States. A lot of talking points used by the Indian government and media are not that dissimilar from the ones used by the Americans in the aftermath of 9/11. However, much of the Western media was careful to distinguish between, quote, good Muslims and bad Muslims. The Indian media has no such compunctions. They openly use the term jihadis to refer to the country's 117 million Muslims. Honestly, it's quite easy to imagine India turning into 1940s Germany with the recent state of the country's biggest minority. If something isn't done soon, India will be a model for other countries around the world, because it is showing us, as I said before, the full extent of what a mixture of fake news, propaganda, politics of division, and hatred can do. Unfortunately, this model has been very successful for the ruling party, and others around the world could be inspired by them. See you next time.